Okay.
All right. So what's next?
Well, we've discussed this whole '80s thing being boring. You talked about
one thing that '80s movies did have for them is the catchphrases that we've really not reclaimed or given due justice in the last few years of movies. I'll be back. Fuck you, asshole. These things are classic.
Indeed. I mean, you can't use the latter one now because you have to be PG-13, but yeah, I'll be back is a big one. Though, I always thought that was such an interesting catchphrase because he says it in Terminator 1, and the whole joke is that then when he returns 30 seconds later, it's with a car, Callahan style, to drive straight through, and then he just decimates all those cops. And I mean, you say what you will, but that was kind of an interesting thing. I mean, that was kind of unexpected, right?
Right. And yeah, this is the one thing that I conceded is that the cop, the police headquarters shootout was fun.
Mm-hmm.
Right. What else? Sarah Connor being the protagonist or the victor in this movie was good. Female empowerment and all that. Linda Hamilton was also in the second movie. She was just great. She did a great job, and you wouldn't have expected it from the character that you see at the very beginning of the first Terminator movie. And
I thought
that was interesting. It was a good sort of plot choice, and the way that she goes from a typical '80s waitress to a soldier, telling Reese to get up off his back and run on your feet, soldier.
Yeah, and I think the big thing there, and I mean, we can talk about Terminator 2, and just, I mean, the story is so well constructed in terms of getting what it needs to do to be what it is, which is a big, boisterous movie, but the justifications for the characters' motivations are all kind of laid out pretty well, and little details, and I think Cameron is actually pretty damn good about this. Just in terms of behavior, especially with the Linda Hamilton, Sarah Connor character, when she's escaping from the mental institution, she does things like she has the guy get down facing the wall in the corner so that like his body will keep the door open for her, but so that he can't see her. You know,
she's trained, right? Yeah.
Like she understands that sort of stuff. And all of that sort of on your feet thinking thing, those little things are so key to, I think, creating, because it's all about, especially with these crazy action movies and this, you know, ridiculous premise and all this other stuff, it's all about being able to do your best within that confine to suspend disbelief, you know, which means that you try to just, if this person seems like they know what they're doing and they're so confident in it and their behavior is indicating someone that's paying attention, then, you know, then I'm there. I'm watching it, and I'm like, okay, I'll watch it. I'll follow this. I'm on board.
Right. They've earned it. They put in the effort. They earned it.
Exactly. I mean, I'm no, like, military-trained specialist, or I don't know any of that stuff, but I can just tell what makes sense in terms of behavior. No, you need to open the door for me. You get down facing the wall, and She really covers herself, especially in that scene, and that's where you really can, especially if you were doing like a marathon of 1 and 2, you would really probably be able to see a major change in that character, like you said, the real arc, which I think mostly happens off screen. It happens between 1 and 2, you know, where she's training with all these guys in Ecuador or wherever they are, somewhere
Mexico,
in Central America, as John says at one point. So that's definitely a good part of the series is that growth of her. I didn't watch the television show, and I honestly couldn't kind of care less. I after thinking about it, I could see how it could fit within the continuity as something sort of between 2 and 3. And even thinking about it more, you mentioned one thing else in your notes is about the issue of time, the time thing, you know, like
time travel. Yeah.
The time travel thing becomes more annoying in 3 and in 4 to a degree. I think that with 4 in a strange way is almost like a prequel film, because if you think about it, Terminator 1 starts in 2029.
Right. It's a prequel in the future, right? Yeah.
Yeah, it's a prequel in the future. All of Terminator 4 is in is in 2018. It's 11 years prior to the events of John Connor leading the final assault on Skynet and winning the war. The war is won at the beginning of Terminator 1.
Right.
And it's over.
Right. So you're right about that. You did say this, or Zach said this, I think, in the other podcast, which is that John Connor is supposed to be the main character of all these films. And that's exactly wrong. John Connor never does anything in any of the films. In the first one, he's not even born. In the second one, he's a fucking bratty little teenager, little snot-nosed teenager. Right. John Connor never accomplishes anything, and the whole structure of these films is that John Connor, just as a matter of circumstance, ends up finding himself in these situations. Which is why it's really it's really strange, but I think it's appropriate in the main movie to have John Connor's story be the B story, because he's never the main character in any of the Terminator films. Even in the third one, he just accidentally finds himself at the military base at the end, right? And it's complete happenstance. The first two films, he doesn't do.
He's forcibly brought there. I think I get what you're saying, but I think, and they don't really play this angle up. They mention it in passing in the fourth one a little, but this whole idea of like predestiny, and that's another time travel angle too, where you've kind of covered yourself on that. If you know, it's like, well, you're supposed to be the big guy that runs the whole show. And I mean, I think what Zach was saying, and what I agree with, is that what you had as an opportunity in this fourth film was a chance to really put John in, right, you know, in a position where he it would be his actual real story, you know?
Yeah.
And instead, we're just not seeing that, unfortunately.
They tried to make a movie about a sympathetic robot, and it just didn't work. I mean,
well, they sort of just redid two, I think. Is
right,
what they
right.
Did. And you know, I would be on board with a film that was more about with the A story, the Sam Worthington thing, if, I mean, they hadn't done the B story with John, or they'd played it down a little more. I could, there were structuring problems there. And honest to golly, this is, I think, about the second or third trailer where I felt like within the trailer they give away one of the main things. I mean, they tell you that he's a robot in the trailer. And I mean, sure, if you're savvy, you're sitting there watching the movie and you didn't see the trailer, you'd maybe figure out he was a robot, or you'd always sort of secretly suspect it. But you wouldn't just bolt blatantly know it from the get-go and be like waiting for the first hour to end so that they could find that. And, you know, it's kind of like you're... It makes the whole first act feel like the first 10 minutes. I mean, the whole first hour feel like the first 10 minutes.
Right. It feels like just a recap of the trailer.
Yeah. Well, you're just like, hey, let's see when the movie's going to start. Is going to be once they've captured him, he's found out he's a robot, and then the movie will start. And you know,
no,
so
that was just yeah.
And up until then, like I said, even at the end, I felt the whole thing really just played like a video game. It was just cutscenes and many missions, pretty much, all throughout, very easily divided.
Right, let's cross this minefield.
Yes, exactly, let's cross the minefield now. Let's defeat this guard robot, or whatever it all is. But we already talked about four, so...
Yeah. So back to time travel. So this is one of the things I said in my notes, and I'm going to stand by this also. There's only two ways to do time travel. One is that you explain the metaphysics of time travel, and if you do that, it must be, this is the law of movies, that it must be exactly as they did time travel in Back to the Future.
It's Back to the Future rules, as opposed to Terminator rules or time
travel
rules.
No, wait. Terminator does not have time travel rules, right? So if you want to do the metaphysics of time travel, you have to do Back to the Future.
In South Park, they mentioned the Terminator rule. The only Terminator rule for time travel is that you can't ever go back. Remember?
Right.
Once you've gone through...
So there's only two things that Reese knows about time travel. One is that you can't go back. It's a one-way mission. And the other is that you have to be organic to go through. You have to have flesh and blood, which is one of the reasons why the Terminator has flesh and blood, right?
It's the big conceit in the first movie for why he couldn't bring like some kind of futuristic sci-fi kick-ass weapon and just win right there.
And the justification for this is, oh, it just doesn't work like that, right? Right. But other than that, right? And Sarah Connor presses him on how the time travel thing works, and he's like, look, I don't know. I'm just a soldier. I'm not an engineer, right?
Exactly.
This is the other way of doing time travel, where you make it so that the characters don't understand how it works themselves.
It's just a mystery.
So it's just a complete mystery. The thing, though, is that by the plot of even the plot of the second movie, but really by the plot of the third and fourth movie, you really need to understand how the metaphysics works to have any idea what's going on at all. Are you still there, Ian?
Yeah, you hear me?
Yeah. You need to right. So Back to the Future rules say that if you change something in the past, what you've done is created an alternative timeline where a different future is going to happen, right? And all these changes happen in a different timeline, so they're not going to affect the original timeline.
Same follows for Dragon Ball Z. Same follows for Star Trek. If you saw the new Star Trek film, exactly. You have these divergent points where there's a time shift and then there's a branching, you know, there was the original reality and then there's the new reality based on that. Right.
So obviously that can't be the way that it works in Terminator, or else there'd be no reason to send Terminators back, because all you'd be doing is changing the future in an alternative dimension. And it doesn't have any effect.
Exactly.
On it, right. So this can't be the explanation, but then it's just a big mystery about how, in Terminator 2, why didn't they just send more Terminators back to the time of the original Terminator and have, or even before then, right, kill Sarah Connor's grandfather or something like that?
Yeah, the biggest flaw in 2 is that they do, you're right, they do never address whether, but that, like Zach said, that's where they opened the can of worms that basically gave them infinite sequels. You know, in a bullshit fashion, you're right, because they don't deal with it. In 1, they clearly deal with everything. I mean, Reese doesn't really know how it works, because Cameron just needed the excuse. He needed the plot device of the time travel.
Right.
But he says we had just won the war. They had just sent one through this time machine thing that they had invented. I went through after, and then we blew the place up. So there's no coming back. There's no nothing else. Everything's done. If I defeat the Terminator, the one thing they got through, then according to this set of whatever, then nothing will happen. You know, they're saying that the causality, they're following that. It has to happen within that reality sort of thing.
Right, and that just doesn't make fucking shit sense. Back to the Future makes perfect sense. Back to the Future is entirely consistent. If time travel works at all, it has to work via DeLorean. These are the movie rules.
Of course. and flux capacitor, which looks like Mr. Fusion and all that.
Right. So the next point was about Frankenstein's monster, right? And this is where I guess we're going to start talking about technology. So
that's fine.
So Frankenstein's monster is one of the archetypes of the way that film deals with technology.
I'd like to address just one thing that my high school English teacher brought up when he discussed Frankenstein and had us all read it. He said the big issue with Frankenstein, what's most prescient, if you will, at the time of its writing, was you had industrialization, which you're right is technology, but then you have the emergence of the middle class, and it's this whole thing about, well, what do you do now that you have this group of people that are not like working constantly to survive and are not just this upper class, presumably very educated, above everybody else thing. You now have this group of people that are kind of, they're angry at the upper class, but because they've got the time to be, but they also, you know, they need to be educated, need to figure out how to live their lives and stuff. And so that's kind of the early on metaphor for that. And you're right, now it essentially it just blows up. The greatness of that story is that it's a perfect sort of analogy for all sorts of, like you said, emerging technologies and new things, where anything that is much like the Terminator, a neural net learning computer, where it can decide to improve or, you know, devolve in terms of its disposition.
Well, so it's easy to read Frankenstein as an allegory for whatever, right? It works as an allegory of the middle class. When Mary Shelley wrote Frankenstein, it was precisely to write just a scary monster. It was written at the same time that Dracula was written, and all the classic movie monsters came out as a result of the same sort of movement to write these. The allegory of the middle class is really just an extension of this more general point that Frankenstein is making, which is also a critique of modern science, I guess, sort of modern liberalism also, in a sense. I guess this is part of what the middle class has to do with, but really a science where through our creation, we make something that runs amok, that runs outside of the way that we want to control it, right?
Mm-hmm. It's absolutely about one group creating something, or something being created that another group that has no idea what to do with it. And
not only doesn't know what to do with it, but can't do everything that it wants with it, that it's autonomous in a certain way, that it doesn't follow, Right? It doesn't do exactly what we say, right? It doesn't do what we say. It has its mind of its own.
Unreliable.
Not just that it's unreliable. I mean, it can be reliable, but it's just independent of us in a strong sense, right? So Frankenstein's monster goes and runs amok outside of the control of Frankenstein, right? Nobody. It's this thing that was created that nobody has any control of. Right? So it's not that they can't depend on it, but it's just that they can't control it, right? And at least one major branch of the discussion of technology in movies follows this formula, where technology is this thing that we can't control. And this is made scary because on top of this, you have this dichotomy between the cold thinking machines that can only do calculations.
Jimmy McNulty behind you going to find the murderer, or what's going on?
I live on the opposite side of the track, on the wrong side of the tracks, Ian.
Oh, is that the problem?
Yeah, and it's a major freeway right next to, like, a hospital and shit, so there's...
Oh, wow. Crazy. There's an airport, too?
There's a water treatment facility.
Oh, that'll do you. Okay, didn't mean to derail.
No problem. Right. So you have this basic idea, and I'm going to call this the idea of technology, which is just the idea that these machines are outside of our control. And then on top of this, you have the dichotomy between... cold calculating machines and caring, loving, emotional humans, right? Where there's something special about what humans do that is outside of the abilities of the machine, right? So in the first Terminator movie, Reese says, all it does is come after you, all it does is come to kill you, you can't stop it, it's never going to stop, it'll keep coming after you, right? It wants nothing else than to kill you, right? And this is the whole idea of robots as monsters, right? They're autonomous, we can't control them, and they have a single purpose and they won't stop until they accomplish that purpose. Whereas humans can choose otherwise, right? They're not single-minded, they're not just cold calculating machines, they're empathetic, they can feel, they have emotions, they might act irrationally, or they might act out of loyalty or courage or some other sort of human quality that machines.
It relates to nature nurture in that way, because you've got the DNA, which is, I mean, if you will, sort of the genetic is genetically the programming of the biological entity of the human being, and that, you know, indicates a lot of things that you will or won't do. You know, you will see within a given spectrum. You know that because you're programmed to by your genes. Much like a Terminator will see a certain way because it's programmed to see that way, you know? But in terms of, like, you're right, behavior, that's always been, that's still the big debate just within humans, you know?
Right. So, I also think this view of technology is ridiculous. So the other major branch of technology, I said this in the notes, is the image of the cyborg, which is this sort of fluid, sort of symbiosis of humans and technology, right? And so
I had a question for you, because Arnold says he's a cyborg,
right,
in T2, but I mean, if we follow Ghost in the Shell rules, a cyborg, to be more precise, is a human brain, and therefore a ghost or soul, because it was, you know, originated from a human being originally, placed inside of a, you know, mechanical pseudo-organic automaton, yes.
Right.
Versus an android, which is completely machine. It's got just a neural network of, you know, I don't know, bells and whistles.
Right, so what do you think?
And it doesn't have a soul, if you will. Yeah, well, I mean, it is, like you said, it is a metaphysical debate that, I mean, is either moot if you say that, well, take a scientific standpoint and say, well, there's no way to prove or disprove the soul, or it's the sort of thing where you look at neurological pathways and maps and things, and you could say, well, if you sufficiently, you know, convolute a given system of synapses and connect and neural network connections, then you arise at this thing called consciousness and so on and so forth, and you could artificially replicate that, then you're right, then it does become sort of like, well, they're the same thing, I guess. And it, and with T2, that's kind of what Cameron is, you know, early on sort of going with, and that's the whole theme, and that's the part at the end where you hear Linda Hamilton in the voiceover talking, you know, a Terminator could learn to love a child or whatever, you
right,
know, there's
right.
The scene where he's clapping five with him, and the kid's teaching him things, he's like, can you learn to be more human? And he's like, well, you know, I'm a learning computer. He can learn to mimic behaviors and all that.
So one of the deleted scenes on Terminator 2, I don't know if you saw this, but there's a scene where they're It's when they're parked at the gas station overnight and they're doing repairs on the Terminator because he's got all these bullets in him and Linda Hamilton's stitching him up. And then there's a deleted scene where they locate his central processing unit that programs in whatever his mission is, and they take it out, and Linda and then he's deactivated. Linda Hamilton goes to smash it, and then the kid John Connor stops her and says, "No, we need him. We need him to be intact." And so stops Linda Hamilton from killing it. I don't know if you saw this deleted scene. It was sort of interesting they left it out, which is too bad.
Well, I mean, I suppose it does seem like a pretty extreme bit of behavior from her side, I guess, and that he would have allowed her to get into it. I see why they could have left it out, though.
Yeah, I mean, pacing issues, yeah. So I think all these questions about human consciousness and stuff are sort of silly.
Well, you're the one that's kind of bringing up the questions that get to it, unless you think that you think there's a different question. I mean, what are you really trying to get at? Are you trying to say with your discussion about technology, is it that humans and machines are the same thing in terms of they're all just basic behavior systems?
No. So go back. You made a distinction between androids and cyborgs, right? You said cyborgs are human brains inside a machine shell, and androids are mostly machines.
It has to do with the manufacturer, basically.
Right. So is Schwarzenegger an android or a cyborg on those definitions?
He would be an android because there's no human brain there.
Right.
There's no born between, you know, no created through biology.
So he has a neural net
thinking,
right?
Aspect. Yeah, he completely explains that. Yeah, he's a neural net, a thinking computer.
Right. That's what he says. And he can a learning computer. Right. So
yeah, learning computer. Yeah.
But that's not enough to make him a cyborg, right? That's not a biological part. That's a machine part.
Yeah. Yeah. If you follow Ghost in the Shell rules, and like you said, I mean, just like any taxonomy, including that in biology, there is a degree of which, you know, you just kind of, you decide to call something based on these somewhat arbitrary rules. But this is a pretty clear
case,
straightforward one. Yeah. Right. You know,
the Terminator never calls himself a cyborg. He calls himself a cybernetic organism. And the idea is that he's part organism in the sense that his flesh is really living tissue, right? The first movie, Reese says that he sweats and he has all the right glands, which is part of why it doesn't make any sense in the second one, where he says he doesn't know how to cry, he doesn't understand what crying is, because he has detailed files on anatomy. He and his flesh is structured such that, I mean, if he can sweat, then he can also cry. It's part of the same fucking system.
Exactly. Yeah. It's the hokey Hollywood aspect. I now know why you cry, you know, and everything.
Right. But he says he's a cybernetic organism, right? So cybernetics is just the field of science that tries to replicate sort of human biological features, right? And so the fact that he has an arm that looks like a human arm is an aspect of cybernetics. That doesn't mean that he's a cyborg in the sense that you're talking about it, but it means that he's sort of structured in an anthropomorphic way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He's an automaton, right?
Right.
He's not
right.
If you follow South Park rules, he's not a robot. He's a, you know, mechanized automaton.
So the other major branch of talking about technology is the cyborg in the sense that I'm using it, which is just the melding of human and machine, right?
By human, you're talking about biological.
I'm talking not only about biological humans, but also humanity. You see images of the cyborg in Brave New World, for instance, where everyone's in the same sort of system, infrastructures, bureaucracies. These are ways of turning of organizing people mechanically, right?
All the Kafkaesque stuff.
Right. So this is the other version of a discussion of technology that doesn't have to do with this autonomous nature. In fact, the whole point of it is that machines aren't autonomous. They're sort of wrapped up in what's biological. I think Cronenberg is the perfect example of a director who works on these issues. Videodrome is probably a classic one of this. It also works in themes dealing with media, and media is another way that technology is relevant in popular culture.
Well, it's a dissemination of information, whether it's necessary. I mean, you know, the quality of the information is not really what we're discussing here, but like
right,
I said.
Right, but it's a kind of technology that aims at social control, but it is definitely technological, but it's not autonomous in the sense that robots are autonomous, right? And so it's just us organizing ourselves socially, right? Becoming the superorganism, becoming the ant hive, or the beehive, or the ant nest, or whatever. Cronenberg does this very well. What's the fucking guy who directs all the Aphex Twin videos?
Oh yeah, that guy, Cunningham.
Cunningham is all his work is based on this idea, right? Rubber Johnny's a perfect example of this, but All Is Full of Love. A lot of the videos he does have this sort of cyborg thing where they're sort of symbiotic and seamlessly integrated. This is the way that I like to talk about technology, and I think really the autonomous view of technology, the view of technology looks at it as Frankenstein's monster, is really symptomatic of the fact that we don't understand the ways in which we actually are integrated with technology, right? So I don't think the idea of autonomous machines or non-autonomous machines, I don't think the image of robots that is portrayed in movies like this really make a lot of sense, partly because they push us to this dichotomy between machines as cold calculating automatons and humans as caring, feeling, childs of God, right?
Absolutely. It's that whole thing. That's the joke. I mean, you know, any sophisticated reading of Terminator is gonna, you know, if it's not going completely out there and, you know, drawing some parallel between the Terminator and, you know, Cold War policies of Ronald Reagan or something ridiculous like that, it's going to say, yeah, it says that all machines are cold and all humans are these, you know, like you said, you know, a human can be much more brutal and cold and calculating, maybe not more cold, but, you know, can certainly be more brutal, I think, than a machine. I think that a machine isn't really capable of these things, right? Because it doesn't appreciate it as a brutality. It's just following its programming. It's the same for a Terminator to terminate someone as it is for a, toaster to make toast.
Right. In the first Terminator movie, Reese gets shot at some point, and he's bleeding all over the place, but he's like, look, it only hit the muscle, it's not that bad. And she's like, oh, doesn't that hurt? And he's like, well, I still feel pain, but you can ignore it. You can put it aside, right? Because he's a soldier, and he doesn't need to succumb to these weak sort of, right? And so you have this weird tension where he's fighting against cold calculating machines, but in order to be a soldier that can fight against them, he's got to at least adopt some of their characteristics, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Right, and so this is the way that the story of technology is just a lot more complicated than Frankenstein's monster, than something that goes that runs amok, that's out of our control. Because right. So the fact that the machine learns in Terminator 2, right? It learns from John Connor. Right, and it learns from John Connor by interacting with John, by playing with it, by sort of walking around and talking to John Connor a whole lot, right? And it's these kind of interactions, social interactions, like so interactions based on language, interactions based on shared activities, projects with shared goals, right? That we learn to interact with technology in a way that doesn't make it out of our control, that doesn't make it just
Well, yeah, you're right. When you take it in a less dramatic, less extreme, I mean, Frankenstein's monster is that. It's super dramatic and extreme. The guy freaks out, he pushes him away and everything. I mean, if it were a different kind of movie, it would be, you know, he'd stop and take a deep breath and he'd teach him and all this other stuff would happen. And you're right, there would be a, like you said, a symbiosis and an interaction there. And I think, I'm sure you must get that in certain films where, you know, the creator of the robot teaches the robot something to some degree. And they learn to live and love each other, and they go palling around and all that, right?
Right. WALL-E is the best example of this ever. By the way, WALL-E is the best robot movie ever. Before I decided to ask you to do the Terminator podcast, I was toying with the idea of making a list of the top five robot movies, but I couldn't get beyond WALL-E. I was like, WALL-E is really just the robot movie, and there's really no other robot movies.
There's iRobot.
iRobot, there's Short Circuit. I mean, there's lots of robot movies, but none of them do robots.
Yeah, none of them are any good. Well, I don't know. Short Circuit was kind of fun, but I get what you mean. Yeah, with what they're doing with Wall-E. I mean, some of the Pixar for kids hokiness aside, it certainly was an interesting choice, an interesting approach to kind of handle those interactions.
Right. Well, I mean, Wall-E doesn't run amok, right? It doesn't go out of control. Even the bad machine, the HAL 9000 machine. That's controlling the ship doesn't go out of control. It's just following its directives, right? It's just following its
directives. Absolutely.
Right. And in Short Circuit, all the robots, all the Johnny models have a directive also, right? They're war machines. But Johnny 5 in the first one gets struck by lightning and suddenly develops, you know, a personality. And then Steve Guttenberg can love it and, you know, and all the stuff. Hey, Ian, I'm going to go get a beer. I'll be right back.